pulse of gamma rays, bouncing them off an object while a reader contained in the unit measures the number of pulses that bounce back. A thick material will repel more gamma rays than thin material. The gauge calculates the percentage of the returning rays against the number emitted. For example, an object that bounces back 50% of the pulses is twice as thick as one that returns only 25%. A more sophisticated version of the technology later evolved into security devices used to scan baggage and individuals at airport checkpoints. In this configuration, with advanced signal processing, the returned gamma rays actually paint a picture, similar to that of an X-ray. When OTS adapted the technology for clandestine purposes in the 1970s, backscatter was widely used in industrial applications, primarily for quality control. It was being used in paper mills to keep the thickness or consistency of paper constant, explained Martin Lambreth, the engineer who helped design the system. By using the backscatter technique, the thickness could be measured continuously as it moved through production. As long as the radiation remained the same, the product was good. If it changed, they'd stop production. We wanted to use the same principle for measuring the distance from our drill bit to the surface of the wall we couldn't see. With the OTS version of the technology, engineers developed a unit attached to a probe that fit into the 3/8-inch drill hole. Tex would drill a short distance into a wall, then withdraw the drill and insert the probe to take a measurement. This drill and probe process continued as the electromechanical counter mounted on the unit recorded a wall's thickness at the deepest point of the drilled hole. In time, Tex became so proficient that some abandoned consulting the small mechanical readout altogether, preferring to judge depth by the clicks of the counter. The faster the clicking sounds, the thicker the wall. Since drilling sometimes occurred in near darkness, this also reduced the need for illumination and added a measure of security to nighttime jobs. I just listened for the clicks. I'd be on a ladder, the gauges on the floor attached by a long cable going click, 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 said Martin, an experienced tech. Then, after a while, I'd hear click, 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 and say, "Something's about to happen. I better be careful from now on." The reading, while not precise, was close enough to eliminate virtually all breakthroughs and earn praise from audio techs around the world. A second drilling innovation adapted from industrial technology was the grit drill. Smooth plaster walls presented a particularly difficult problem for the audio techs. It seemed that every diplomat who happened to be an operational target also had an office or home with plastered walls. To cut through the plaster, some pressure was needed on the drill, but no matter how careful the tech tried to be, that pressure was just enough to spall the other side of the wall. Small chips of plaster from spalling were a dead giveaway to anyone doing a security inspection. OTS management dispatched an engineer, working under an alias as well as commercial cover to obscure CIA interest, on a nationwide tour to find a solution. Lugging dozens of circular samples of brick, concrete, ceramic tiles, terrazzo, and other materials neatly packaged in plastic sleeves, he began a cross-country journey in search of a better drill. He visited more than a dozen companies, large and small. Anyone who knew anything about drilling through hard materials was fair game. Those who agreed to meet with the engineer were told that his company was looking for a drill so fine and so tough it could penetrate every one of the circular samples with a clean 1 millimeter hole. He visited precision drilling companies that cut holes in circuit boards and scientists in labs working with microwave energy. In upstate New York, he paid a call on a company that excavated concrete and was anxious to help. "I think we can do it," said one of the mining engineers. "We would use a very small controlled explosive with great care." The tech found the concept intriguing, but the idea of using explosives, no matter how small, was not something he could likely sell to OTS. The engineer eventually found a research company in the South that said it had a scientist with a reputation for innovative engineering. So far, the search had been futile, but he went through the requirements yet again. There was little reaction, except the scientist asked that some of the material samples be left behind. Because it was the last stop on the circuit, the tech was happy to discard the weight from his luggage. Back at OTS, he reported little progress on the problem. Nothing happened for a few weeks, and then, unexpectedly, the OTS engineer received a call from the scientist who had kept the samples. "I've got a solution," offered the caller, and the engineer was on the next plane going south. At the lab, the scientist rigged up an old thermal drill, a type used for a brief time by dentists. The drill utilized a very fine nozzle and air pressure to shoot a thin, high-velocity stream of extremely small aluminum oxide particles, essentially eroding the tooth's enamel to create a hole rather than drilling it out. While erosion eliminated some of the discomfort of pressure during drilling, patient complaints about the taste of the particles made the technology unacceptable. The OTS engineer pulled out samples of every possible material, and the two went to work. They drilled holes in glass, concrete, plaster, stucco, and ceramic tile. No material was spared from testing, and a clean hole appeared in each sample. Both engineer and scientist admired what the drill had accomplished. "Works great. You solved the spall problem. And it's no good to us," the engineer told the stunned scientist. A lengthy conversation followed as the engineer pointed out that despite the precise clean holes, the drill would not be usable in a clandestine operation since it sent a fine spray of particles through the hole at breakthrough. If a target room was on the other side of the hole, the drill would deposit a fine coating of dust on carpet, furniture, and files that would surely alert the room's occupant. The scientist listened intently and asked questions about the nature of operations and the special tools that were required. "Can I keep working on this?" he asked. The OTS engineer readily agreed. Here was a scientist with demonstrated creativity and who was clearly hooked by the challenge of clandestine requirements. Had he been a case officer, the engineer would have claimed a recruitment. A few days later, an OTS secretary took a cryptic phone message from the scientist. "Tell my friend to come on down. He'll know what it's about." The following day, the OTS engineer watched as the scientist attached a sleeve to the device that was inserted into the hole being drilled. The drill went into the sleeve, which was sealed around the outside of the hole. Extending from the collar was a hose that ran from a filtering system to a clear plexiglass tube. He blew the grit back into part of a vacuum cleaner bag so he could filter the stuff out. Then coming out of the vacuum bag was a clear tube, and in that tube was a ping-pong ball and a photoelectric cell on the side. That was the on-off switch, the engineer explained. So when the gas came on for drilling, it created air pressure in the tube and lifted the ping-pong ball. While drilling, he had positive gas flow and the ball stayed up. As soon as the drill tip broke through, the pressure in the tube dropped. The ping-pong ball fell, triggering the photoelectric cell, and the damn thing turned off. The operational dust problem was solved, along with the problem of cutting a clean pinhole through smooth plaster. OTS engineers reconfigured the device for portability and named it the grit drill. Helium was substituted for compressed air for its higher exit velocity. The entire grit drill and its accessories could be squeezed into a standard briefcase. Once the grit drill kit was certified for deployment, the well-traveled engineer received orders to demonstrate the system to the overseas OTS tech bases. There, skeptical audio techs assembled for a demonstration of the latest solution from headquarters. For field types, the headquarters show-and-tells had a reputation for bringing more hype than practical value. The engineer described the system, explained why it worked, and demonstrated how to set it up. He then began punching tiny holes through materials the most susceptible to spalling. Each tiny hole was perfect, with no spall appearing on the target side of the sample materials. But before the demonstration was finished, the chief of audio operations interrupted. "I've seen enough," he declared. "I'm doing an operation tomorrow. Bring that thing along, because you're going with me." The engineer was stunned. Not only had he never been on a clandestine operation, the grit drill had never been used operationally. 3 days later, the engineer's anxiety had turned to excitement. The operation went smoothly, with the engineer personally operating the grit drill during its first use in an audio installation. Now with an operational success as part of his briefing, he visited other techs in the region demonstrating the drill to interested audiences. But it was the thrill of the clandestine work that stayed with him. Like his scientist friend, he had been hooked by the excitement of clandestine operations. Back at headquarters, after completing the show-and-tell TDY, the engineer transferred from his lab assignment to the cadre of audio tech officers. As the audio surveillance equipment improved, and inventories of transmitters, power sources, microphones, and installation tools grew, the techs themselves required additional training to configure and test equipment. The era of the tinkerer had ended. The days of on-the-job, trial-and-error audio training gave way to more rigorous and formal instruction aimed at greater professionalism and broader knowledge of increasingly complex equipment. "If we weren't doing this, we'd be robbing banks," said Antonio J. "Tony" Mendez, one of three OTS technical officers honored in 1997 as a CIA trailblazer. No element of an audio operation created a more intense adrenaline rush than a surreptitious entry into a secure and guarded target. Surreptitious entry, defined as an entry by stealth, accompanied almost every clandestine audio installation. In most instances, the tech entered the premises or property of the target and then made additional entries into luggage, mail, or vehicles. Due to the risk involved, surreptitious entries were thoroughly scripted and rehearsed prior to the operation. During World War II, the OSS created a surreptitious entry capability by enlisting former second-story men with prior experience in burglary, lockpicking, and safecracking. OSS created and issued a small lockpicking knife containing picks instead of blades that could be conveniently carried in the operative's pocket for quick access when needed. The original OSS surreptitious entry manual cited the purpose for their work as helping the agent solve his problem. He wishes to obtain access to secret documents, copy or memorize their contents, and leave the premises in the same condition as he found them. To arouse suspicion that the entry had been made would in many cases be as fatal as being caught in the act of rifling the safe. The agent should therefore learn thoroughly the technique of surreptitious entry so as to adapt it, as the occasion requires, to a similar job in enemy territory. The reasons for conducting entry operations did not change after World War II, only now the enemy territory became the guarded official missions of America's Cold War adversaries scattered in countries throughout the world. While all the audio techs were trained in the basics of surreptitious entry, a handful of officers specialized in the work. These techs were skilled at climbing ladders, bypassing alarm systems, picking locks, cracking safes, and performing room searches as well as installing devices. These entry specialists demonstrated that, if given sufficient time and resources, virtually any lock could be opened and any alarm system bypassed, though there were always limits on time and the amount of equipment that could be deployed at the job site. Regardless of how easy lockpicking was represented to be on television and in the movies, the techniques of manipulating locks required skill and practice. At best, picking remained more an art than science. One TSD tech remembered sitting at home in a European capital in the late 1960s, working through the weekend to get the feel for opening a new brand of foreign lock. The first successful attempt required more than 12 hours, but once he had acquired the feel, he could open the lock in less than 5 minutes. Target sites were usually well protected, and the more valuable the information inside, the more layers of protection surrounded it. Locks, secured doors, gates, windows, file cabinets, vaults, safes, and even the alarm systems. A lock specialist had to be proficient in dozens of mechanisms, since locks in different parts of the world varied in type and method of operation. The techs discovered that German locks were particularly difficult compared to those in South Asia. The grab bag of different locks and security architecture the techs found in countries from Ghana to Paraguay ranged from early colonial to state-of-the-art. With narrow time windows for covert installations, The techs had to know how many minutes were required to break through locks and security barriers and then restore and rearm the security systems. Information on all of these factors was obtained in a detailed pre-installation clandestine survey of the target conducted by techs and included in the operational proposal. Only after headquarters approval of the survey could an installation operation commence. Under the best of circumstances, the CIA would obtain advance information that a Soviet intelligence officer planned to move into a new apartment, or that the Chinese government was renting an office suite for a new trade mission. If possible, local support agents were recruited to rent or even buy office space, apartments, houses, or property adjacent to target buildings. Techs infrequently picked a lock, preferring to find other methods to gain entry. Picking took too long, the results were unpredictable, scratches from the picking on the mechanism or housing were detectable, and once a lock was picked open, it had to be picked close at the end of the operation. Sometimes, when the location was known far enough in advance, the techs could wire the vacant property before its occupants moved in. Architectural spaces, such as the attics of row house buildings, were particularly inviting, since their design offered a contiguous common space over each unit. Once the tech gained access into the attic, he had unobstructed movement to any top-floor unit in the row. Buildings might also provide common basement areas, with several outside entrances that enabled the tech team to avoid being seen coming and going through the front door. Given complete access and unlimited time to do the installation, the techs planted multiple microphones and transmitters, as well as ran wires, precluding the need to pick any locks. Depending on the relationship with security services of the host country, known collectively as Liaison, the CIA could assign the task of performing an entry to Liaison. In many countries, the Internal Security Service already had duplicate keys to all rooms in every major hotel, and master keys for apartment houses and important commercial buildings. The techs also made duplicate keys. By the early 1960s, master keys for every popular hotel in more than one major European city hung neatly on a rack in the tech's shop in local stations. When possible, case officers would beg, borrow, bribe, or steal master or original keys. OTS had key-cutting machines at its bases, and the traveling techs carried portable key-making devices that fit inside a briefcase. From the popularly sized and configured blank, the techs could cut a duplicate within a few minutes. For keys that were briefly available, OTS developed a portable key impressioning kit. The kit consisted of a small mold with two halves filled with plastic modeling putty. The purloined key was placed on the putty, and the two halves of the mold pressed together to capture a three-dimensional model of the key. Later, the tech could pour Woods metal into the mold and create an exact copy of the key. The last choice was to attempt to pick an unknown lock. For this contingency, OTS issued leather lockpick kits that were small enough to fit in a jacket pocket, but provided the necessary tools for picking and raking the tumblers of many commonly found locks. These portable kits were most useful for opening luggage, desk drawers, and other smaller locks. In the late 1960s, a TSD engineer developed a concept that mechanisms within key-operated locks could be measured and characterized remotely by marrying emerging ultrasonic measurement technologies with an oscilloscope. Portable oscilloscopes had just been introduced, and when combined with a small ultrasonic device, the techs would have a tool they could carry easily to the target, use to measure the lengths of the pins in a lock, and thereby acquire the precise data to make a key. Once the engineer produced a prototype device that produced accurate calculations, OTS contractors refined the design for a field-deployable unit. A year later, after the device proved itself by enabling several surreptitious entries into previously inaccessible targets, Cord Meyer, the Associate Deputy Director for Plans, recognized the engineer with a special award that included a $5,000 stipend. In his presentation, Meyer said he could not mention what was acquired from the entries, but added, "This is the largest stipend the DDP has ever awarded for a technical development. This gadget is right out of the James Bond movies. Not all entry operations involved breaking into rooms or safes. HT Lingual, for example, was the CIA's controversial Cold War program that intercepted and examined U.S. mail to and from the Soviet Union. Covert mail intercept required skills in flaps and seals to open and reseal envelopes, cartons, and packages thought to contain intelligence. Surreptitious opening and surreptitious entry shared the common objectives: to get inside a protected area and copy or steal the contents. The two primary methods for opening a sealed gummed flap, such as on an envelope, were dry openings and steaming. From 1940 to 1973, the FBI, and later the CIA, conducted covert activities to open and photograph suspect mail in the United States. The earliest techniques of chamfering, mail opening, were taught to the FBI by a friendly Allied intelligence service during World War II. Information obtained from these programs was sanitized to protect against revealing sources and was disseminated to the intelligence agencies, the Attorney General, and the President of the United States. As the Cold War intensified, the CIA initiated its mail opening project in New York to target mail from the Soviet Union. The HT Lingual operation was conducted by the counterintelligence staff and the Office of Security with TSD's assistance. Over a 20-year period, more than 215,000 letters to and from the Soviet Union were opened and photographed in New York. The New York Mail Project originated in 1952 with a proposal to scan exteriors of all letters to the Soviet Union and record the names and addresses of the correspondents as a means of identifying U.S. contacts of Soviet intelligence. The project expanded when James Angleton, chief of the counterintelligence staff, advised Richard Helms, then acting deputy director for plans, of a need to open and examine a selected portion of the letters. He advised Helms that there was no capability for searching for secret writing and/or microdots, or to determine whether items have been previously opened, and to open items sealed with the more difficult and sophisticated adhesives. TSD set up a lab in New York in 1961 to test letters for secret writing chemicals and to study Soviet censorship techniques. Because technical examination was time-consuming, only a small percentage of the letters opened and photographed were actually tested. The Manhattan Field Office of the CIA's Office of Security handled most of the opening and photographing. Those who opened the mail attended a one-week course called Flaps and Seals, conducted by TSD at CIA headquarters. The basic method of opening the mail was simple. First, the glue on the envelopes was softened by steam from a kettle, and with the aid of a narrow stick, the flap was pried open and the letter removed. One of the agents who opened the mail testified, "You could do it with your own teapot at home." It took approximately 5 to 15 seconds to open a letter. At one point, the CIA developed a type of steam oven capable of handling about 100 letters simultaneously, but its performance was judged inadequate, and the agents soon returned to the kettle and stick method. The original letters, which had been opened, photographed, and possibly subjected to TSD examination, were resealed and returned the next morning to the airport for reinsertion into the mail stream. Translations and summaries of the letters' contents were disseminated within the agency and to the FBI. As the sophistication of the technology and number of audio installations expanded, OTS developed an intense year-long training program for the audio techs designed around the lessons and mistakes from the early years. In addition to learning the ins and outs of the technology itself, novice techs were taught the basics of building walls, mixing plaster, matching paint, restoring wallpaper, and making repairs after a device was implanted. They learned how to pick locks, make key impressions, cut keys from blanks, manipulate combination locks, and do electrical and telephone wiring. There was every kind of reconstruction. One of our instructors was a master plasterer who, before retiring, worked in the White House and the Capitol, recalled one tech. We had a dedicated facility, an old food warehouse in Alexandria, Virginia, where we'd learn how to mix mortar and lay brick. It didn't matter if you had a college degree or not. If you wanted to be a tech, you took that training. For a typical lesson, the master plasterer assigned trainees to build a wall, plaster it over, then knock holes in it to simulate burying audio equipment and replaster it. Then came the tough part. Not the least impressed by the tech's CIA affiliation, the plasterer would shine his flashlight on the gleaming wall, silently studying the work, then invite the tech to join him as he pointed out a ripple here and another there. No ripple was acceptable. "Nope, not good enough," were dreaded words. With those, the tech knocked down his wall and started over. The coursework on walls and plastering alone lasted a month, and then came paint matching, which included training with special paints that OTS formulated to be fast-drying and odorless. Specialized soldering courses followed, along with instruction about glues, adhesives, tapes, and fasteners that hold things together. The techs had to learn how to open and close all types of materials, fabrics, leather, wood, concrete, and masonry, in preparation for burying bugs in any concealment that might be in a target environment. The techs received training to operate laser surveillance systems that, by projecting a laser through a window, could pick up audio from minute vibrations of the window pane in the target room. Although these officers were audio specialists, overseas stations would not hesitate to ask their help in all other disciplines of OTS, so familiarization was provided in the full range of ancient communication, including microdot, secret writing, photography, and short-range electronic systems. They didn't skimp on training at headquarters. It was thorough and hands-on. And in the field, every new officer got a mentor, a more senior audio officer, for their first tour, said the tech. You didn't do anything on your own. You traveled with somebody else, and they showed you the ropes. You drank beer together, stayed in the tech hotels, and if you wanted to succeed, you listened to the lore, no matter how long that lasted late at night. These field mentors also provided valuable unofficial training. Junior techs learned how to economize on space while taking the necessary tools for jobs that were never completely predictable. One tech always carried four types of tape wrapped around a number two lead pencil. Individual rolls of tape added weight, required space, and contained far more tape than was ever needed on most jobs. Duct tape, double-sided tape, electrical tape, and copper foil tape were standards. Duct tape held devices in place while the epoxy dried. Double-sided tape was used to stick components to walls or ceilings in temporary configurations for testing. Electrical tape insulated and repaired wiring, and the copper foil with sticky backing made good practice or emergency test antennas. There was always room on the pencil to wind several loops of solder wire and utility wire as well. Epoxy was the tech's best friend. The strength of small amounts and its brief curing time were important to completing a permanent installation quickly. It could repair broken housings, fill cracks and holes, and hold equipment suspended at awkward angles in almost any location. Epoxy could also teach a lifelong lesson. A tech on his first job, and anxious to please his mentor, was asked to quickly prepare a batch of epoxy. Without seeing a container to hold the mixture, the tech squirted the two components into his palm and stirred them together. His palm became warm, then very hot. Yet the tech's professional pride and urgency to get the installation finished overrode the burning pain. He said nothing until the team returned to base, and the medics treated him for a first-degree burn that permanently scarred his palm. While techs were officially a service that responded to DO operational requirements, they frequently became involved in defining the requirement and developing the operational proposal for headquarters. When operational proposals required technical detail, the writing responsibility fell to the tech. All technical operations required formal approval from both OTS, weighing in on the technical feasibility, and the operational division, which evaluated intelligence value and counterintelligence risk. Therefore, the field proposal issued under the local chief's signature became all-important. The COS always had the final word on the proposal, but the techs established informal codes to communicate.